Good morning. Welcome to Daily Sabbath. This is our final Tuesday in our series, The Ongoing Reformation, Lutheran Diversity Worldwide. A special thanks to Marcia Bungie for all of her coordination of our speakers and for having a vision for this series and helping us implement it. Also, thanks to the team in the Office of the Chaplains for all of the extra special touches that we did for this series. We are excited today to have Dr. Eric Carlson with us from the History Department. After having journeyed around the world and learning about Lutherans around the world, he will be speaking to us about the unfinished business of the Reformation. So thank you for being here, Eric. We will begin by standing and singing our opening hymn, number 509. 509. Continue with a gospel reading from John chapter 17, verses 10 through 19. All mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I have been glorified in them. And now I am no longer in the world, but they are in the world, and I am coming to you. Holy God, protect them in your name that you have given me, so that they may be one as we are one. While I was with them, I protected them in your name that you have given me. I guarded them, and not one of them was lost, except the one destined to be lost, so that the scripture might be fulfilled. But now I am coming to you, and I speak these things in the world, so that they may have my joy made complete in themselves. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, because they do not belong to the world, just as I do not belong to the world. I am not asking you to take them out of the world, but I ask you to protect them from the evil one. They do not belong to the world, just as I do not belong to the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. Holy wisdom, holy word. Thanks be to God. You may be seated.
Given the reading from Scripture that I chose for today, it probably won't surprise you to learn that I'm going to identify the unfinished business of the Reformation as Christian unity. It is, of course, well known that Martin Luther did not intend to establish a new church or a new religion. His goal was to reform abuses in the existing one, and at least initially he was confident in a wonderfully naive way that if he just got a fair hearing and people just read the New Testament, they would come around to his way of seeing. Would that it were so simple. By the mid-1520s, it was pretty clear that Luther wouldn't get that hearing. Battle lines were being drawn. Although some people, like the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, stubbornly continued to try to find some resolution, none would be forthcoming. In what would effectively be his last attempt at restoring unity, Charles had Luther's followers bring a full statement of their beliefs to an imperial diet in the city of Augsburg in 1530. That text, the Augsburg Confession, or Augustana, became not the basis for healing the breach, but for making it more pronounced. Now, Luther's supporters had a clear statement of beliefs around which they could rally, a source of identity. Indeed, it's worth noting that they were not referred to as Lutherans. They were, in official imperial texts, the followers of the Augsburg Confession. In 1547, followers of the Augsburg Confession and of the old religion, which is what they called themselves, went to war. Although the reformers' side lost, defeat just hardened their resolve. Within a few years, Charles V was so fed up that he resigned as emperor and dumped the whole steaming mess on his brother. Meanwhile, in Switzerland, a whole other reformation had developed under the leadership of the Zurich preacher Ulrich Zwingli. Luther couldn't entirely decide whether the Pope or Zwingli was the bigger danger to Christians, and Zwingli had some fairly unrepeatable things to say about Luther in return. By the 1540s, another reformation was well underway in Geneva under the leadership of John Calvin. It was effectively to take over in places that had initially followed Zwingli, while also making inroads in parts of Germany and France, becoming the established church in Scotland, and shaping much of the theology, although not the structure, of the Church of England. And these were just the versions of reform that were embraced by the authorities in some territories and could flourish unmolested. Those who rejected infant baptism, called Anabaptists by their foes, professed other beliefs, including for many a refusal to bear arms or participate in government. And these views got them seen as dangerous subversives and either executed in ways that were barbaric even by the standards of the 16th century or driven into exile. And while all of this was going on, local churches were developing their own forms of worship, which sometimes involved radical redesigns of worship space and even the destruction of images, whether they be painted, sculpted, or glazed. Some retained a structured liturgy with set prayers that were used each time they gathered for worship. Others virtually eliminated liturgy in favor of spontaneous prayers by the minister and very long sermons. Some embraced the congregational hymn singing pioneered by Luther. Others would sing only psalms. Within 100 years of Luther's initial assault on abuses, Western European Christianity was a patchwork quilt of confessions that could barely stand to breathe the same air as the others, fearing that the slightest contact would jeopardize their salvation. Since each believed that it had the truth, the others, not just Catholics but other Protestants, had to be following not the truth. And that could only mean one thing, for Satan was the father of lies. Why the history lesson? Well, I really can't help myself. I am a historian. But also because I think it's impossible to talk about the prospects for Christian unity without being honest about the origins of and reasons for Christian disunity. To take one example, I mentioned that Luther and Zwingli had pretty low opinions of each other. This was largely because of their divergent beliefs on the Lord's Supper. Although Luther argued that it was unnecessary to believe in the Roman teaching that the bread and wine literally became the body and blood of Christ through a process called transubstantiation, since that notion was a human invention not found in the Bible, it was still necessary to believe that the bread and wine did literally become the body and blood of Christ, because Jesus said so. Zwingli, on the other hand, insisted that Jesus was speaking metaphorically, noting that Jesus often used physical objects when speaking of himself. He was a vine, a door, and so on. He didn't mean it literally. The bread and wine only symbolized Jesus, and reminded Rome what he had done for us. The theological distance between Rome and Wittenberg on the Eucharist was truly quite a bit less than between Wittenberg and Zurich. At the time, people used differences such as this to excuse flinging curses at each other and declared with certainty the damnation of those who held opposing views. For the most part, we've gotten over that bit. But the Lord's Supper continues to be a source of division. My own church, the Episcopal Church, which is the American offshoot of the Church of England, invites all Christians to receive communion without asking questions about what the recipient thinks it is that he or she is receiving. I sort of like that, and it's one of the main reasons I'm a member of the Episcopal Church. But a Roman Catholic or a Missouri Synod Lutheran attending my church, perhaps for a wedding or funeral, would not, if following the rules of their own churches, be able to accept our invitation to communion. Nor can I receive communion in a Catholic church, although I believe every bit as much as Catholics do, and maybe more, that the bread and wine are really the body and blood of Christ. There has been some progress on this issue. Last year, a committee of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and representatives of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America agreed that, in fact, both believed in the reality of Christ's presence in the bread and wine, while still differing on how it happened, and that was the important thing. Two cheers. What about the current generation of descendants of Calvinists and Anabaptists, though? All of those Presbyterians and Congregationalists and Baptists and Mennonites, to name but a few. They have a profoundly different view, one that is sincerely held and, truth be told, is not irrational. There are other areas of disagreement dividing Christians that I am personally less willing to label rational, such as objecting to the ordination of women or to a married ministry. And, of course, there's the big sticking point, the role of the Bishop of Rome, a.k.a. the Pope. In his 1995 encyclical, Ut Unum Sint, That All May Be One, Pope John Paul II apologized for the rhetoric and actions of past popes, which he acknowledged had caused pain to non-Catholic Christians. Nonetheless, he insisted that the unity that was God's will for the Church could only happen under the absolute authority of the Pope, and he declared that that was a truth which was unchangeable for Catholics. The starting point of John Paul II's encyclical was the observation that Christian disunity was an obstacle to evangelization, that it's hard to persuade non-Christians of the truth of Christianity when we're all squabbling amongst ourselves about what we believe. Fair point. But what I want to suggest today is that we need to start thinking about Christian unity differently. The legacy of the Reformation is, for better or worse, that we have lots of different forms of Christianity. Frankly, I think we need to start seeing it as a strength that we have choices. I like liturgy. I like set prayers that are used every Sunday. I like candles, and I like organ music. Lots of people don't, and that's okay. These are matters of taste. I keep going back in my head to the reason why I left the Catholic Church in the first place and became an Episcopalian back when I was in graduate school. When I went to the Catholic Church, I couldn't pray. And when I went to the Episcopal Church, I could. That's about me, about where I could encounter God. Other people can do it best in Catholic churches, others in Quaker meetings. Great, go for it. If we continue to think of Christian unity as being about eliminating the different ways we express and pursue our relationship with God, I think we're doomed. The Reformation, without meaning to, gave us choices. What it did not do was compromise one fundamental truth: that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, that he is the Messiah, and that he died to reconcile us sinners to God. Does anything else really matter?
We will continue by standing and singing hymn number 594, verses 1 through 4. That's hymn number 594, verses 1 through 4. Following the service, we invite you to join us for coffee and juice and cookies, as well as some special Hanukkah coins. Hanukkah begins this evening, and so we have those as well. Go in peace to love and to serve. Thanks be to God.